What I'd like to do is to talk about the cult of equities. We've had a 40-year history in which our industry has emerged from a fledgling small industry of institutional asset management to an industry that actually shapes capital markets and shapes economies in many ways all over the world. But with that 40-year evolution of our industry, we've also seen the evolution of what I would characterize as a cult of equities. Equities are seen as something special. They're seen as something that should always be our core investment. The myth of stocks for the long run belies the fact that stocks sometimes can go through extended periods of disappointment. The myth of the 5% risk premium for stocks is pervasive, even though when you dig beneath the surface, you find that the reality is less impressive. There's a myth that stocks loft from one new high to the next, interrupted briefly by periodic annoyances known as bear markets. Now, I'm not saying that stocks are bad. I'm just suggesting that stocks are, like any other asset, likely to be wonderful if we buy them cheap, and if we buy them at market tops at very expensive levels, we may have to wait a long, long time to be pleased with the outcome. In your materials, there's a series of exhibits. I'm going to hopscotch through them because some of them, I think, relate directly to this very topic. If you look at Exhibit 8, if you have it in front of you, there's a graph that shows U.S. stock versus bond relative wealth, the relative wealth of a stock market investor compared to a long treasury bond investor going back 200 years. Now, there's a common view out there that as long as you're patient, as long as your time horizon is, let's say, 10 or maybe 20 years, that you're going to be better off with stocks. And that's often true. But it's also sometimes false. If we go back historically, we find that the stock market investor in 1803 had to wait 68 years before they were ahead of the bond investor. So the notion of stocks for the long run, where you're hoping your great-grandkids are better off because you chose stocks, that's all well and good. Back in 1929, the peak just before the crash ahead of the Great Depression, you had to wait 20 years to beat bonds. And if you go back 40 years to 1969, bonds were at yield levels that were comparatively high. Those yield levels fell over the subsequent 40 years, most notably over the last year of 2008. And as a consequence, bond returns got pushed up. Stocks were at a peak in 1969, just before the secular bear market that spanned 68 to 1982. And so stocks, coming off of a peak 40 years ago and finishing at a trough this last winter, wound up being revalued downward, being revalued to a level that depressed their long-term returns. And as a consequence of that, we had a 40-year span, 40 years, in which ordinary treasury bonds outperformed stocks. And what we often fairly easily forget is that the decade of the 70s was brutal for stocks and for bonds. So this was not helped by by bonds doing especially well in the early part of that 40 years. So the notion that stocks reliably beat bonds over extended periods of time is a myth. They do win in the very long run. Now, another thing that's interesting on this exhibit is that over the last 200 years, the stock market investor would have wound up about 200 times better off than the bond investor. That's huge, but that's only 2.5% a year. 2.5% a year compounds to 200 times the relative wealth. That means that stocks beat bonds by 2.5% a year, not the much vaunted 5% a year that we always hear about. Elroy Dimson and a couple of colleagues put together a book called The Triumph of the Optimists, in which he looked at the 20th century. And what we find there is that in markets that did not experience war on their home soil, and U.S., of course, was one of those, in markets that did not experience war on their home soil, stocks beat bonds by an average of 4 to 5% during a period of upward revaluation in stock market valuation levels. In markets where war was fought on the home soil, stocks had real returns that were 2 to 3% lower over the course of a century. And so again, this myth of the 5% risk premium is in fact a myth. Another thing that's fascinating on this self-same exhibit is you can see the crash of 1929 on the exhibit. You can see a few years later, the market had wiggled around for about 20 years. In 1949, there was a trough just before it took off. By the time we reached 1965, that line had gone from 5 to 150, meaning that cumulatively the stock investor had gone from 5 times as wealthy as the bond investor to 150 times as wealthy, a 30-fold gain. That was in 16 years. 16 years comprised a 30-fold gain. Strip that period out, a period of time when bond yields were soaring as investors realized that with fiat money, now that we were off a gold standard, inflation was a normal part of the investment process. And what we find is that yields went up, valuations went down, bond returns were depressed, stocks soared, and as a consequence of that, two-thirds of that 2.5% risk premium for stocks relative to bonds was earned in a 16-month span. The next couple of exhibits show the real price level for stocks, just stripping out inflation and ignoring dividends, not because they don't matter, but because you're collecting the dividends, and people talk about stock bull markets in terms of the price index level, the level of the market ratcheting to new highs. And what we find is that over the last 200 years, stocks have risen about tenfold net of inflation. That's surprisingly anemic. The other thing we find is that over 80% of the time is spent during spans of time where we wait 15 years or longer to reach a new real peak level for the stock market. So the notion that the stock market ratchets to new highs on a regular basis, interrupted by brief disappointments known as bear markets, is indeed a myth. 80% of the time we're in spans 15 years or longer, during which time we're waiting patiently for a new high. I suspect we're in one such span today. Exhibit 11 shows a capital markets line that's unlike any that we're accustomed to seeing. It's one in which T-bills over the last decade had a 4% return and stocks had a minus 1% return, kind of inverting the conventional view of the risk premium. And in fact, every asset class outside of mainstream stocks and T-bills is above that line, had an alpha relative to stocks. So there's really three paths to improving our prospective returns. One, we aren't locked into using stocks. We can use bonds. We can use alternative markets. We can use emerging market stocks and bonds. We can use commodities. We can use inflation-linked bonds. These are all very interesting additions to our toolkit. If we don't use them, we're limiting our opportunity set. Secondly, we can seek alpha. And there's two forms of alpha. One is the good kind, positive alpha. The other is the bad kind, negative alpha. We all think about alpha kind of like we think about chocolate or love. It gets the pheromones going, and alpha is seen as a positive, wonderful thing. It's wonderful if it's positive. It's not very wonderful if it's negative. And the simple fact is alpha is a zero-sum game, and the quest for alpha has costs. So most alpha, in fact, is slightly negative. What that means is that most of us, in our quest for alpha, are overlooking the fact that one of the most powerful ways to improve portfolio returns is to look for, seek out, identify, and eliminate sources of negative alpha. This is a very powerful part of our toolkit that most of us don't use to the extent that we could. The third is to actively manage our asset mix, to include alternatives in our spectrum of opportunity, to seek out markets that are out of favor, unloved, even loathed, and to use those when they're out of favor, recognizing the power of mean reversion to help us out. This reciprocally requires taking whatever is trendy, popular, and comfortable. The capital markets don't reward comfort. To eliminate those from our portfolios and to look for ways to redeploy our money into areas that are out of favor. Now, each of these is found also within the stock market, which leads to the second segment of my remarks, which will be very short, focusing on fundamental index. And that is, return chasing behavior is all too common in the markets. The power of rebalancing and enjoying the benefits of contra-trading against conventional wisdom, contra-trading against fads, bubbles, constantly shifting market expectations, and crashes. That contra-trading adds value. We do it in the asset allocation arena. We do it typically in the form of rebalancing and sometimes in the form of tactical asset allocation, moving out of the cherished and much beloved areas of the market and seeking opportunity in areas that are a little less comfortable. And yet we don't rebalance within the stock market. Within the stock market, if a stock doubles in price, our exposure doubles. And that's inherent in the nature of markets, but we don't have to live with that. We can rebalance within the stock market. The failure to rebalance is actually a source of about 25 to 100 basis point drag at the asset allocation level. It's also a source of about 200 basis points to 300 basis points drag within the stock market. And finally, improper diversification represents another opportunity to redress a problem, to eliminate a source of negative alpha in our portfolios. Now, cap weighting has an Achilles heel. Cap weighting takes any investment that's trading at premium multiples and gives it premium weight in our portfolio. What this also means is that if a company is at twice the market multiple and another company is at half the market multiple, we have four times as much in this company as this relative to the company's size. Well, that's a pretty serious, pretty enormous bet. Is it because this is a better company? Yes. Is it because this is a better stock and a better investment? No. If the capital markets are doing their jobs right, then the risk-adjusted return on the high multiple company should be just the same as the low multiple company, meaning that we have most of our money in something that doesn't have a return advantage. One precept of successful investing is that we want to put more money into assets that we think will perform better. I mean, that's just a truism. So if a company doubles in price and so doubles in weight in the cap-weighted portfolio, does that mean that efficient markets theory is telling us that the stock that just doubled is more attractive and has a higher prospective return than it did before it doubled? Yes. Yes, that is one of the assumptions, and it flies in the face of common sense. One of the things that I think is awfully interesting is that the spread between growth and value changes over time. Sometimes it's an enormous spread, as it was at the peak of the tech bubble. Tech stocks were trading at massive multiples. The mainstream industrial companies were trading at multiples in line with historic norms. What happened? The spread narrowed. And that spread narrowing came in the context of value outperforming growth for the next 7 years. Now, what's happened since 2007? The spread has widened out again. The spread has widened out to a point that is wider than it has been at any time in recent post-World War II history, with the sole exception of the tech bubble. What does that mean? That means one of two things. It means either the world will do without these deep value stocks, and they're all going to fail, or that the growth stocks are going to achieve stellar success, or that the spread is too wide. If it's too wide, value will outperform, growth will underperform, creating a mean reversion back to normal spreads. I think that's what's going to happen. And one of the beauties of fundamental index is that it weights companies by how big they are, not by their market cap, not by how big the market thinks they'll be in the future and prepays for today, but by how big they are now. That doesn't mean that it's equivalent to fair value weighting. Nobody knows what the fair value is. What it does mean is that you've got a nice, stable, sensible anchor, an anchor with economic meaning, namely the size of the company, an anchor for contra-trading against the market's constantly shifting expectations, speculations, fads, bubbles, and crashes. And that creates an opportunity that I think is very, very interesting today. Fundamental Index has been around now for closing in on 4 years, and over that four-year span, growth has beat value. Over that four-year span, globally, Fundamental Index has beat cap weighting by 3% a year compounded.
Okay.
So those who suggest that it's pure value.
I'm going to stop you there now if I could, Rob, because
sure.
I'd like to keep some time for interaction. So there's been a chance for the audience to give their feedback by way of questions. And in the first instance, I'd like to ask my colleague Tim Farrelly to give you a question, and then we'll go to some of the questions from the audience.
Perfect.
Hi, Rob. I guess one of the questions comes from one of your last comments that value is at a very big spread at the moment to growth, in which case you would look, well, anticipate that we're going to get good performance out of value going ahead. One of the speakers yesterday said that now that the market has woken up to value as being something that generally has outperformed for very long periods of time, it's likely to be that outperformance will be more volatile than it has been in the past. Would you see that as being likely?
I don't know about more volatile. It's been volatile historically. That is to say, the spread between growth and value has exhibited a certain amount of variability over time. I don't think it's necessarily going to be more or less volatile in the future. But what I would say is that when the spread between growth and value is unusually wide, history suggests again and again that growth wins over the subsequent 2 to 4 year span. I think we're looking at exactly that situation right now. One of the areas of low-hanging fruit in the markets, I think, is deep value. One of the areas of stretched valuation that I think is highly vulnerable, I think, are the extreme growth stocks.
Okay. Another one comment you made earlier on was in terms of asset allocation more broadly, that we should go about, we should try and seek out-of-favour markets. What do you see as some of the big out-of-favour markets at the moment? And perhaps the ones that are in favour, some of the discussion points as we've been going along in the last day or two is most of the speakers have been very favourably disposed towards emerging markets and very favourably disposed towards commodities. And with that consensus, it doesn't feel like it's out of favour. How do you feel about that?
I think I would agree with your tacit assumption. Emerging market stocks have soared in the last 5 months. The returns have been truly spectacular. The fundamental index for emerging markets is up over 70% in 5 months. It's an enormous run. So I think emerging markets represent a very important growth opportunity for economies in the world. The opportunity to catch up is tremendous. A lot of that's in the price. Now, one of the things that I think is really interesting is that in emerging markets, if you cap weight, most of your money is in the two or three companies in each country that are best connected, best respected, most beloved, and most extravagantly expensive. If you fundamentally weight within emerging markets, you're spreading your bets and participating in the more rapid economic growth in these economies. So I think fundamental index in emerging markets is very interesting. I think cap-weighted emerging markets portfolios will struggle to show any incremental return over the next 3 years because of the enormous run that they've had. On the bond side, I think the opportunities are a little bit more robust. That is to say, I think emerging markets debt today is priced at a fairly large risk premium to developed world debt. It's 2 to 4% these days, and yet most emerging markets debt is now investment grade. So that's a wider spread than the quality would normally justify. So I think emerging markets debt represents a continuing opportunity. I forgot what the second part of your question was. Sorry.
No, that's fine. You've got that one. A broader question, which is, if we accept this, the premise that equities just don't always outperform in the long term, and most people in the audience, a lot of their business practices are built around the idea that equities do outperform in the long term, what sort of changes would you suggest they should be making to the way they run their investments, recognizing that equities may not be the winner over all periods or long periods of
time? Firstly, let me push back a little bit. In your question, you said the premise that stocks don't always outperform. The fact that they don't always outperform. Investment managers have to do what they're good at. And one of the distinguishing attributes of the successful investment manager is they know what they're good at, and they stick to what they're good at. And if what you're good at is stock investing, don't change it. If what you're good at is macro strategic thinking, broaden your horizons and look to add value for your clients in equities, in bonds, in alternative investments. And if you're a plan sponsor, if you're the owner of the assets, diversify more broadly. Don't view stocks as the be-all and the end-all, as the core portfolio for all time. View it as part of your toolkit to be used when it's cheap, to be underweighted when it's expensive, and to be replaced with more interesting assets on those occasions where stocks are very, very fully valued. I don't think they're very fully valued right now, but I do think they're no longer cheap. I would also distinguish between U.S. and Australia. Your yields are easily 50% higher than ours. I think buying in Australia right now makes a lot more sense than buying in the U.S. right now.
Okay. You've mentioned alternatives. For typical retail-type investors, what are the types of alternatives they can get access to, and how would they do it? Which are the attractive ones right now?
I'm going to punt on that from the Australian investor's perspective because I don't know. From the U.S. investor's perspective, you've got emerging markets, stocks, and bonds. You've got value and growth in emerging markets. You've got commodities. There are commodity funds. You've got the ability to access real estate through REITs. You've got the ability to access inflation-linked bonds. There's a whole spectrum of opportunities, and at any given time, one or another of those might be wonderfully attractive, and others might be very expensive. Right now, in stark contrast to 6 months ago, I think there's a lot of fairly expensive, fairly fully priced markets given the geopolitical and geoeconomic outlook, which I think remains a little bit challenged. Not a little bit. Remains challenged. And I think a lot of markets have gotten ahead of themselves. But by the same token, 6 months ago, we saw a situation where there was more low-hanging fruit, more interesting investment alternatives than I think most of us have had the opportunity to exploit in our lifetimes previously. And it would not necessarily be a bad thing to revisit those opportunities if, in fact, markets come back down and wind up struggling. That creates buying opportunities. A lot of folks think down markets are a horrible thing. They aren't, unless you're planning to spend the money right away. They're buying opportunities.
Rob Arnott, we're going to call it quits there and say thank you very much for you two taking the time in the West Coast and speaking with us here in Sydney. Please, ladies and gentlemen, give a vote of thanks to Rob Arnott.
Thank you very much for your time.